Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd. I'm your host today, Jessica Kesselman, and I am so excited to be joined by a dear friend of mine and a community favorite, Joe Prince. He is the owner of Divine Bar and Grape Divine. Grape Divine is a wine shop, a pretty dynamic one, in Spark Hill, New York. And it has got quite a following, and there is a reason for it. And the reason is Joe himself and his staff and the incredible selection of wines he has. The reason I asked Joe here is because Joe and I have kind of struck up a partnership of wine and cheese pairing events. And, you know, when I started in cheese, I thought I learned enough about wine and cheese pairings through teaching and learning from some great folks. And when Joe and I started doing these events together, I was introduced to a whole array of pairings I never would have thought of. And since we're in that funky time between Thanksgiving and New Year's, I thought it would be a great time to talk about wine and cheese pairings and kind of take it off the rails a little bit. So I want to welcome Joe to Cutting the Curd.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
And so I just want to talk a little bit about your background and like how we got to this place of wine and cheese, how you came from a background in food and how it influences your role as an influencer to a lot of palates when it comes to wine and spirits.
I started cooking, prepping vegetables actually at age 14 in New York City for society's number one caterer when I was essentially a boy. And I got to go to the famous homes of people as I was growing up and catering to Jackie Onassis' birthday party and, you know, a variety of celebrities' homes. I was privy to a lot of things that a lot of people have never seen before. And I thought, wow, this is a very interesting, fascinating career to cater 1,000 people at the New York State Theater at age 16. I was, you know, obviously just, you know, a very small player in that whole role. But I thought, this is fascinating. I really love cooking. And when it came time to go to culinary school when I was 18, I jumped in there with both feet. I loved every minute of it. So that was that started me off when I was quite young. And when I finished, I started to work for another caterer in Manhattan who I had known when I was 16 years old in the business. So I worked for her for a number of years. Then I left to work with Glorious Food in Washington, D.C. and did Ronald Reagan's inaugural luncheon in 1985. And then I stayed on and met a gentleman who was interested in cooking, opening a restaurant and needing a chef. So that was me in 1985. And I had a number of restaurants since then. I was written up in the Washington Post many times. And I love cooking. And it's in my blood. My parents, my dad, on Saturday mornings, he would cook. Both of my parents worked. And on Saturday mornings is the time I got to spend the most time with both of my parents. And my dad and I cooked in the kitchen all the time. So I always equated food with love and being with family from an early age. And when I turned 40 or so, I just ran out of gas. You know, you do that as a chef. You just don't have enough energy any longer. And then I opened my wine store in 2002. And here we are, almost 20 years later.
So making the leap from food to wine, you and I have talked a lot, over the time we've known each other about tastes and flavors and how they can influence each other, wine and food. So what for you is exciting about pairings, and what do you have any kind of standards, guidelines, or do you just kind of throw passion to the wind? Like, what's your approach to that? Someone walks in and says, "Oh, I'm having such and such for dinner. Can you tell me what wine I should?"
Well, that always makes me so happy to hear that, because that's kind of where I excel, in my mind at least. When people come in and say, "I'm going to have a pasta with red sauce," or "I'm going to have a tenderloin," "I'm going to have a steak burned up on the grill," or "I'm going to have lamb." From experience, and doing this for 20 years and having been a chef, I really understand how all those flavors and the complexities of the wine go really well with that food that you're chewing in your mouth and swallowing, you know, not at the same time, but sometimes at the same time. But I do love that opportunity to show off. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's very subjective.
Right.
And I do think people trust me at this point. Because they come back very often and they say, "Boy, that lamb pairing with the Châteauneuf du Pape, or that lamb pairing with that Côte d'Or was absolutely great." Mm-hmm. And it's interesting here in the store. I always try to find a wine that over delivers for the money. I always try to find something that, you know, why drink a $50 bottle if you can find one that, you know, for $15 that drinks like that. So mm-hmm. I'm always on the hunt for that. And I have always been that way. I've always tried to find some value. When I first opened in 2002, there was nothing in the store more than $20 on the shelf for about 6 or 8 months. And then a lot of customers came in and said, "Suppose I'd like to have, something more expensive." Bill Murray, for one, asked me if I wanted to, you know, if he wanted to get a Montrachet or something. And I was like, "Okay, I guess I have to expand now." Mm-hmm. But I love the opportunity to put the food and the wine together, because I think I understand, you know, the difference between a Bordeaux and a California Cabernet, especially when it comes to steak on the grill. You know, a Bordeaux is typically a little bit too pulled back, and it'll be overwhelmed by, you know, a burned up steak on the grill, but it goes beautifully with a tenderloin of beef. So you understand the little nuances of the flavors.
And that actually, even though you're talking about red meat, it applies to cheese. I mean, sometimes we describe cheeses as being meaty. Sometimes we talk about cheese using a lot of the same descriptors that we talk about any other type of food. We'll talk about it being vegetal. We'll talk about it being mushroomy. We'll talk about it being herbaceous or yeasty. So a lot of those rules can apply. And I should point out for people, when I mentioned Spark Hill, New York, I doubt that many people know where that is. It's this little town, village, part of Orange Town, New York, and Rockland County, but we're really close to Manhattan, and we're just over the border with New Jersey, and it's a little bit off the radar, but because of its proximity to the city and to other metropolitan areas, the palates here can be a little bit more
discerning.
Yeah. And
the confidence of wealthy people who have traveled, and they know their food and they know their wine. And then there are locals who are just learning about it all, and everybody's welcome.
And I would say, even among the locals, some of them come from families with long traditions of traditional Italian, you know, particularly Italian cuisine or customs, traditions. I know my family, my husband's family, my in-laws, you know, they've been here for a couple generations from Italy, and they still drink they grew up, their parents, their grandparents grew up drinking certain wines and eating certain foods and eating certain cheeses, and those persist. Yeah, for sure. So, one of the, reasons that I am so excited to have you is to talk about holiday forward cheese and wine pairings. And it's not as if people are going to sit around at a holiday party specifically eating the cheese and wine the way we would in a formal class. But there are opportunities to just, you know, for the wow factor, make people really excited about what they're eating, what they're drinking. And so I thought we could just go through a few pairings suggestions. You know, we can do general, we can do more specific. But I did want to start off with one that one of these pairings that kind of made me think differently about wine and cheese. So when I first started in the cheese game, you know, and I would teach these like, you know, wine and cheese 101 kind of classes, I was always taught that Chardonnays were a no-no with pairing cheese, that the whole thing would just be too flabby, too buttery. The Chardonnay just didn't have enough acidity to cut through the fat of cheese, that it would all just be kind of flat. And to lean more towards Sauvignon Blancs, things a little bit more citrusy, a little bit, you know, more minerality. And so I just like gave the big X with my fingers whenever somebody said Chardonnay. And we have a couple of times done events and you have paired a nice cheese early on in our progression. So we, you know, we start with the mild, we start with the goat, we start with something bloomy, maybe a double or triple cream. And there you come walking along with the Chardonnay. And I was
you didn't give it any credit at all. I know, but Chardonnay comes in so many forms. When I first start in this business, you go for the obvious big flavors and the things that really kind of attack your palate. And you're like, wow, I love oaky, I love buttery Chardonnay. Until you don't, until you've had your first Burgundy, until you've had your first Marchais, or your first entry-level Bourgogne is also an unbelievably delicious wine. And it has attack, it has acidity, it has... all you wine folks out there who get this, you really do understand that it's a very different animal altogether. It's like creamy lime peel, it has a lot more attack and more minerality in the back end, and it just lasts and lasts and lasts. And I think for pairing with cheese, that's a really easy wine to put together with a goat, especially, you know, all kinds of goat, because the more acidic in the back end, the more it'll cut through all the fat. And you really, the two of them pair so nicely together. I make a goat cheese French toast at home, you know, for brunch occasionally. And I'll either open a nice champagne with it, which is, again, for the most part, white Burgundy with sparkles, you know, because when I look for champagne flavors, I also like to find champagne that drinks like white Burgundy with a beautiful little, you know, tiny little bubble to it. So that's a great combination. And that's a staple.
Right.
What do you think of this?
So when he said, what do you think of this? We are sitting together in person across the table from each other. And this is the first interview since I started on Cutting the Curd that I am doing in person because COVID. So we're sitting here drinking wine and we are in front of a...
Cutting the curd.
And yeah, we're cutting the curd. We're sitting in front of a cheese plate. And this that he's pointing at is not a Chardonnay, but it's really tasty.
Really juicy, varietally correct Grenache from Spain, but it's not one of those super high alcohol, you know, big attack wines. This has really got lots of flavor and like, isn't it? It's so easy and mellow.
It know? Is. And I think, again, you use the word not high, where it's not high in alcohol. And we... You know, another thing that, you know, cheese and wine pairing 101 is watching the alcohol.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why, you know, I've always been the big beer and cheese person, because you can go with some really nice beers that are more around 8.5% or so. You don't have to, you know, but wine, you can get into the scary numbers.
Scary numbers.
And that can just destroy any of the nuances of a cheese. But this one is really nice. It is really light and it's a red.
Yep. So easier and juicy, you know, and it could pair with so many different things.
Yeah.
A poisse.
A poisse, yes. So we're moving on from that Chardonnay option as your opening bid. and we're moving on to those stinkers, Epoisse, Taleggio, and then we have some really great American wash rinds. I always love using Grayson from Meadow Creek Dairy because it has, you know, some of that beefiness, that meatiness. There's some really great wash rinds being made in the United States right now. So I could definitely see this is a Spanish Grenache, you said.
Spanish Grenache.
What else do you like to pair with a poisse?
Oh my God, there's so many. I don't go country to country. You know, a poisse is French, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, it would be great with a Burgundy, you know, a red Burgundy. I love red Burgundy as well for the natural, the simplistic way in which it's made. They ferment, they pick, they squeeze, they ferment, they leave it in neutral barrels, and they put it in bottle. And you get a vintage, and you get a place. And that's what is so appealing to me about Burgundy. I love the lack of attention to it, because they pick it when it's ripe, and they ferment it, and they bottle it. And I love the cranberry notes in it. I love the flavors that... the interplay with it, because it's earthy. It's an old, you know, typically an old world style wine, unless you're getting a ripe vintage like 2018. But I do love Burgundy with a lot of cheeses. Epoisse is definitely one of them. And I was just backing up to when you said stinky cheese, up to the stinky cheeses. I love, is it a question of age, or is it a question of understanding what your palate is all about, Jessica? Because when I was a kid, people used to say, oh, this you're going to hate this. It smells awful. And I'm not going to use all the phrases that they smell like right. This and that. But now I really, really like the smellier, you know, the stuff. Taleggio, oh my God. I mean, I can make a pizza with Taleggio and be very, mm-hmm. very, very happy with that.
Right.
Is it a question of age?
I think it's bad advertising that when we were growing up, and I think kids today are growing up with a different appreciation of food, and especially how smell, scent interacts with flavor. But we grew up being told that things that smelled strongly were not for kids, right? That we wouldn't like it because of the way it smelled. And the truth is that when you taste a poisse, when you taste any cheese that's strong scented, a lot of times it's actually a very buttery, very delicious. Yeah, there is nothing off-putting about it. And understanding also what contributes to that scent is part of the appreciation of this amazing cheese. And it's funny because before we started talking for this interview, you gave me a glass of a natural wine that went through a variety of different smells. While I was sitting here, you know, every few seconds you were like, what do you smell now? What do you taste now? What do you taste now? Because it kept changing and developing. And I mean, that's part of the experience of enjoyment for wine and cheese. And so I think part of it is just, you know, appreciating this multidimensional, multisensory experience of eating. I think if you had Taleggio pizza when you were a kid, you would have loved it, but mm-hmm. somebody told you wouldn't because it smelled strongly.
Yeah, it smells strongly.
You know, I think we do a big disservice when we tell kids, oh, you're not going to like it. But
I have a quick question for you about cheese rinds.
Uh-huh.
I typically rarely take the rind off of the cheese unless mm-hmm. it's got wax in it. I love all of the way the cheese is meant to taste.
Right.
And when you go to a party and people start to dig into it like a brie, they'll dig out the brie
yes.
and leave the rind.
Yeah.
And they'll leave the rinds all behind. And obviously that's part of the experience of eating it. It's mm-hmm. I feel like people are missing that.
Right.
And I love the whole experience of, you know, I will very often take the rinds off and eat them by themselves just so I can taste what they taste like.
Yeah.
And my dogs love Parmesan cheese rind.
Let me tell you.
They wait for me when I'm, you know, making something at the house. That I open up the refrigerator and they hear the refrigerator door opening up where the cheeses are. And they stand there like, okay. And they're all, they fight over the cheese rinds.
Right.
Except for me, because I eat the cheese rinds too.
Yeah.
But don't you feel the same way, kind of? I mean,
yeah.
What cheese rinds don't you like to eat, except for the ones that have... That's an interesting one.
Yeah, that's a wedge of Comté, which actually, if I am not mistaken, it may be time for us to take a break for a word from our sponsor, which is Comté. So we're going to pause for... Yeah, nicely done there. We're going to pause for a minute or so and hear from our sponsors and come back with Joe Prince.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté Cheese Association represents the Comté PDO, Comté Protected Designation of Origin in the USA. Comté is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Comté within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Comté. Comté takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Comté is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Comté is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Comté is unique. Learn more about Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
And we're back at Cutting the Curd with my guest today, Joe Prince. He is the owner of Grape Divine, a wine shop in Sparkill, New York. And it's right next door to Divine Bar, which is a pretty amazing restaurant. If you ever find yourself in Rockland County, you just definitely check out both places. And we were just talking about wine and cheese pairings for the holidays and trying to think a little bit outside the box for pairings. You know, we've already talked about Chardonnay as a possibility. We talked about Grenache. We've talked about Burgundy. And we're talking a little bit about what, you know, the way we approach flavor and smell with cheese and wine. I really want to make sure we address this. Another crazy, mind-blowing experience for me, because there was a time when I really didn't know very much about wine and cheese, was the first time I actually ever met you, Joe, was in your old location. And I came in because I was doing a private event at a country club, a wine and cheese pairing event with a very discerning wine committee. And you turned me on to a sparkling red. And I had never had a sparkling red before. I think it was actually one from Australia. But since then, you've turned me on to the world of Lambrusco. Mm, yeah. And I, you know, there was a time when I thought champagne was the, you know, the thing, the go-to. Then I got introduced to Cava. Mm-hmm. Then I got introduced to Prosecco. Now, all of a sudden, I'm all about the Lambrusco. Mm. Like, can you talk a little bit about why you love Lambrusco so much and why does it keep coming up every time we do these wine and cheese events?
Lambrusco, unfortunately, when I was a kid growing up, there was a brand that I'm not going to disparage, but it was all over the television when they could still advertise for alcohol on television. And, you know, it kind of, in my mind, I was, you know, I had heard it so much that when I tried it, I was like, yuck, I didn't like it at all. But over time, winemaking has evolved. And everything has changed for the better. Everything has kind of grown up. Winemaking, they've discovered that, you know, you cut you prune the grapes to shade the grapes from the sun, from 3 o'clock on, because that's where the heat is. Just as an example, not to digress, but there's leaps and bounds in winemaking since the 70s when I was kind of a kid. But this grape, the Gasparilla grape, it comes in so many different expressions. There are the fruity kind. There's dry. There's white. There's rosé. And I have really embraced them all because it's really kind of in the hands of the winemaker. And I love how they express this grape individually. I like how the whites take on a little champagne-y note, typically. May I mention the name of somebody, of a wine?
Go for it.
Linney makes a really delicious rosé and white Lambrusco. And I truly love what they make. I just got a text today from one of my wholesalers who says this particular new Lambrusco just got 95 points, which I'm going to order and bring into the store for the holidays. But this is typically, I got turned on to it a long, long time ago after I got over the shock of what it could be, having lunch with an Italian friend of mine. And he just laid out some very simple prosciutto and some Parmesan cheese and a number of other Italian cheeses. And he pulled the cork on this off dry Lambrusco. And he said, have you ever had Lambrusco? And I was like, kinda. And I poured this into my glass and it was a completely different experience. Again, it was off dry, had a little fruit to it, but the back end of it tasted like a really great Italian red wine. And when the bubbles were gone, it was so expressive. I loved drinking it. And I recommend it to a lot of people, and it's caught fire recently in the last 2 years. More and more people coming in and asking for it. Well, and a lot more people are food and wine savvy. And the New York Times writes about something, the next day everybody's walking into the store to say, do you have such and such, mm-hmm. and such and such and such? And, when they did their whole, many years ago, to digress one more time, they did a whole article about rosé. And up until that article, everybody compared it with this white Zinfandel. And they said, rosé is not white Zinfandel. You must try X, Y, and Z, all these, different makers. And the next week in my store, people walked in. It was like the floodgates had opened for rosé. Everybody wanted rosé suddenly. And it was the defining moment. I think it was like 2003 or 2004 when everybody changed. So Lambrusco to me now is the Sunday afternoon, easygoing, make some focaccia, have a little Lambrusco. You have some preserved meats and some great cheeses and a little salad, and your day is solid. It's just beautiful wine.
Right.
And unsung until recently. So
would you say go for it on New Year's or Christmas? And I'm fully on board.
Well, I said, on Thanksgiving. I sold a lot for Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
I recommended we have red, white, and rosé here. And everybody enjoyed, everybody has, responded by saying, can we get some more of that? Mm-hmm. Which, that tells me I've done my job well when they've come back and asked for it again.
Right, right. Is there an American equivalent?
I can't think of a sparkling red right now that's American, but we should capitalize on it. There's no reason the Veneto growing region area somewhere right here. Unfortunately, it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. So it's going to be difficult to find a grape growing region that can make Lambrusco. Mm. But I wish there were, because I'd subscribe to it. In Italy, it's a Vernaccia that comes very close to the Lambrusco. And it's a red Vernaccia, but it's made of, oddly enough, it's made from Garnacha, but it tastes like Lambrusco. That's what I'm trying to say. And it's really rich and fruity, and then the end is dry. And it's surprising because you think you've nailed this when you put it in your mouth and you think, wow, this is going to be a total fruit bomb. And what turns into something quite beautiful and layered and, you know, finishes just beautifully. That's what I like to be surprised with wine. I like when a wine smells like it's going to throw you completely. Your mouth is expecting to taste this, and you put it in your mouth and you're like, wow, that was not what I was expecting at all.
Right.
That's what I love. That's kind of what natural wines have done, because you smell them, you try them. The extra contact white wines, the skin contact white wines, you know, stay on the leaves for a day or two or three or four or five or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And then it changes. You were saying it smelled like ham. To me, it smelled a little bit like tangerine at first, but the wine changes and evolves as you are sipping it. And that's kind of what I like about the natural wines, because it's not what you would expect, and it's always changing.
So how do you pair something that's always changing with food that's kind of staying the way it is when it reaches your plate?
Right. Well, you have to open it. I tell people all the time, open it early. Open it early, and it'll arrive at this flavor toward the end.
Ah.
And that's and what I'm tasting as a professional, you know, wine store owner. A lot of the times the wine will arrive to me from the wine rep, and it's been open for 45 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. So it's breathed. It's had time to, you know, express itself completely. So they come and pour it for me if the bottle is open. And I take a big sniff in the glass, and it's, wow, it's really delicious, and I really get it. So friends of mine will come over, and I'll uncork it, and I'll pour it into their glasses, and it smells nothing like the wine that I recalled. And I'm scratching my head. In 45 minutes or half an hour or even 15 minutes later, the wine completely changes. And that's the most interesting part of wine for me.
Mm-hmm.
How it evolves.
Right.
And I love how it changes in your glass in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour. And I had kind of a rule of thumb for older wines. If they're more than, if they're 20 years old, I like to put them open them up and let them breathe for 5 minutes for every year it's been in the bottle.
Wow.
And
okay.
It really does, because it's really been close. It hasn't had it taken a breath for 20 years or 15 years or however long these wines are. So that's kind of my rule of thumb. But when they get really old, they lose a lot of their fruit, and you pretty much have to pour them in a glass and taste them over time, because they don't hold their fruit content as long, you know, because they're old. They're much older. But that's kind of my simple rule of thumb. 5 minutes for every year it's been in the bottle.
Right.
And it really kind of opens up at that point.
So what wines and cheese are you looking forward to enjoying this over the next, like, 6 weeks, when all we're doing is eating with people, cooking, you know, trying to, you know, capture the holiday spirit?
I love anything that goes with white Burgundy, red Burgundy, and Nebbiolo.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Epoisse. I love Parmesan cheese, 3 or 4 year old Parmesan cheese, when it cracks, when you go into it and it just does that.
Mm-hmm.
I love the stronger cheeses. I love Comté.
Yeah, this one's got a lot of those amazing crystals in it. So it's kind of crunchy. Not unlike what you were saying about wine, you know, over time, this keeps changing, you know.
And what is the Dutch cheese that
Gouda?
Gouda. Oh, the aged Goudas with all the protein rinds that taste salt, the protein bits that taste like salt. I love that. Those are my favorite cheeses. Really hard. And actually, they say the harder the cheese, the better it is for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've lost a lot of its fat content.
No, it's lost a lot of its water content.
Water content. Oh, yeah. It's still fat.
Fat and dry matter is how we.
Fat and dry matter.
Yeah.
I love it. This is delish.
Yeah, it is really good.
Wow, very. It's nutty, and I would have a cheese that. There's a wine that we have downstairs in the southwest of France. that I love, and it's called Pasharenk.
Mm-hmm.
And the wine, it's typically made in a dessert style, but this particular wine is nutty, just like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I love old Chenin Blancs.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are great with Comté.
So I have a question. It's kind of wine adjacent, and that's vermouth. So vermouth seems to be having a moment, and you carry quite a number of types of vermouth, brands of vermouth. What's up with vermouth? Because I only know it as, like, okay, I'm going to show my naivete here. I only know it as an ingredient in Italian cocktails. So,
okay.
But recently I was in the shop and one of your colleagues gave me a taste of one straight up. I've never had anything like it.
I think vermouth is now catching fire. Again, I think vermouth is an unsung, it's a misunderstood, unless you're in Spain or in France. The Europeans have figured it out a little bit before we have. It's an interesting way to mix herbs and fruits together, and wine, obviously, to make a very unique flavor profile. That does, a lot of people have this as an aperitif in Spain and in Italy. And I absolutely love vermouth, plain vermouth as an aperitif. There's a wine of vermouth now called Method that we absolutely love. It was Danny Meyer tasked the guys who were the bartenders at the Gramercy Tavern and who worked for him down in the city. And they came up with this absolutely perfect sweet vermouth, a Torino style sweet vermouth. And that's all we like to drink anymore. I love this. It's a little fruitier for most people, but it's quite good. There we have five or six kinds of French vermouth. We have Greek vermouth. We have four Spanish vermouths at this point, and they're all slightly different, but they're all delicious. Make sure I taste everything in the store before we put it on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all unique, and most of the staff can describe exactly what it tastes like.
Right.
I love vermouth. And I also like it in bourbon. I like it in bourbon, and I like it in the Negroni.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Of course.
But in a bourbon, that... Actually, I can kind of see that, like the smokiness and the fruitiness
mm-hmm.
kind of going together. I mean, there was something a little syrupy about the vermouth.
Mm-hmm.
It almost made me think of, like, I could pair that with a blue cheese, with like a spicy blue or something a little earthy.
Spicy blue cheese.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there comes a point when you've eaten, when, you know, we always say, like, what's the best way to learn about cheese? And what's the best way to learn about wine? And it's just taste, taste, taste,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And there gets to be a point where you can do, it almost feels like you can do pairings blindly. Like, you don't need to sit and compare, like, oh, okay, let's test out these and see which one's going to go with this thing. Once you kind of get the characteristics of something down, you can pretty much know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that's going to go well with et cetera, which is what is so interesting about doing wine and cheese pairings. And even what a great thing to do over the holidays. You're together with your friends, and especially if we're not ready to go back to large gatherings, but you just have like 6 or 10 people around and you just create a flight
mm-hmm.
and just.
And nobody's wrong.
Nobody's wrong.
Everybody's right.
Everybody's right.
The homework assignment is beautiful.
Yeah.
So I just want to tell you one funny story. Back in 2002, I was doing wine tastings in my old store. And I realized that this fabulous champagne that I had discovered would go as well with caviar as it would with a Twinkie. So I bought some caviar. I had 10 people in the store. And we had caviar and a little potato with some creme fraiche. And I opened some Twinkies, and they went. It was perfect because Twinkies, yuck. But with the champagne, it somehow elevated the whole Twinkie option. And obviously, champagne and caviar go really well together. And people were like, "What? What do you want? Twinkies?" And they were all very impressed with how well they went together.
So okay, so we all need to get Twinkies
and
our boards
and champagne.
And champagne.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of what cheese would. go with that. With Twinkies and champagne. I'm stumped. If you give me a little bit of time, I think I could probably figure it out.
Stump the curd lady.
I don't, yeah.
Very nice.
I don't know, man. But I do think, you know, when you were talking about the vermouth and you mentioned there were ones from Greece, I could totally see that with a lot of those Greek cheeses, mm-hmm. especially like the grilling ones. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, just, yeah, definitely. I could see that.
We have one downstairs that's pink and it's called Otto and it is stained with beets. Mm-hmm. That's how, where it gets its pink from. Mm-hmm. But it is flavorful and fruity and so many herbs in this. It's remarkably delicious.
Right.
Love, you know, again, before dinner, after dinner, in a drink, vermouth is honestly getting great steam right now.
So just wanted to check in about availability right now because, you know, we all hear about all of the delays and the distribution backups, which seem to be easing. How are things looking going into the holidays for you?
Well, the obvious champagnes that I was trying to bring in, they advised to bring them in much earlier than I did, unfortunately. So I was out of luck with several of the well-known names that people ask for, but we specialize in the things that people don't know. So we find these, you know, offbeat champagnes that we absolutely love. So we are good with champagne, and we've had a little bit of a hiccup with wine from New Zealand, getting in on the boats, and Slovenia, believe it or not, I have a nice selection of Slovenian wines, and they still haven't arrived, and they were ordered in September.
Wow.
So they're still on the boat somewhere.
Right.
So that, unfortunately, I'll have to wait until February to bring those in. But there is definitely a supply issue. But I'm only tasting wines and bringing wines in that they have plenty of.
Right. And what about wines from the United States? Anything you gravitating towards right now? Or
I like upstate New York Rieslings. I like Oregon wines a lot. I like Pinot Noirs from Oregon. I like Pinot Gris from Oregon. I have friends of mine making wine in Texas.
Texas,
yeah. California Cabernets are this is a sad story. California Cabernets are not getting enough water. They're getting too much heat. They're getting too much fire. Yep. They're getting too many things that will eventually change the way, you know, winemaking is done out there, because they've had to use secondary use water to water the grapes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made a joke. I said, you know, when these wines start tasting like poo-poo, we understand why, because the water has been coming from, you know,
right,
toilets, right, basically, to water this. So there's, it's very hot now, and there's not enough water to water everything out there, as we all understand. So that's whole winemaking system is going to have to change out there, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But Oregon still, yeah, there are fires in Oregon, but they're a little bit more nuanced. I like a little softer, more delicate wines. I don't like wines that are super high in alcohol. I like them lower in alcohol so I can have a conversation and finish a bottle of wine and continue to have the conversation. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Very true. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with...
We have to do this again.
Yes, we do have to do this again. And as I always find when I do one of these interviews, is that it just like leads to so many other topics that we can delve into. But I'm hoping that some people, you know, listening kind of, you know, take some of the things you said as an opportunity to explore some different pairings beyond the Sauvignon Blancs and Pinot Grigios and the Pinot Noirs. I think there's, like you said, there's no real wrong answer. You know, you just got to experiment and find a really great wine shop.
Yay. Thank you.
It's true, right? Like
true.
Wine shops, cheese shops,
right.
You know, we need our mongers of all
our lovers and our mongers,
our purveyors and mongers of all of the ancient foods. Mm-hmm. And happy holidays.
And happy holidays.
And for everybody out there, you know, you always check out our Instagram page and the Heritage Radio Network website. And we look forward to seeing you again back on Cutting the Curd.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.